apologize for this opportunity to participate in this nice workshop. And I'm going to talk on the corona and completion problems for a certain Banach algebra, which we'll denote by A+. And this Banach algebra arises as the set of Laplace transforms of certain measures on the line, which have their support in 0, infinity. And the elements of this Banach algebra serve as transfer functions of stable control systems. So they arise naturally in control theory. And then the corona and completion problems for this Banach algebra, they play a role in a certain problem in control theory known as the stabilization problem. So I'll explain what all these things mean, and I'll also outline the proofs of these two theorems, and that's what this talk is about. So first I'll explain what we mean by linear control system, and I'll give the definition of this algebra A+, which serves as a set of transfer functions of stable control systems. Then I'll explain what is meant by the stabilization problem, because the corona theorem for this Banach algebra A+ plays a role in this stabilization problem. And then I'll outline a proof of the known corona theorem for A+, and finally I'll also talk something about the new completion problem for A+, which also plays a role in this stabilization problem. So a linear control system is basically a mapping which sends input functions u to corresponding output functions y, and this input function u and output functions function y are functions on the half line 0, infinity, which can be thought of as the time axis, and they take scalar values. And the output is obtained from the input by convolution with a distribution with support on 0, infinity, or you can think of it as a measure. So we can think of a control system as a box which, given an input function u, produces a corresponding output function. If I change the input function u, a different output is produced, and the aim in control theory is to manipulate or control the behavior of the y by suitably changing the input u. And this this measure mu is known as the impulse response of this system, because when you feed in the impulse, the Dirac measure supported at 0, then the corresponding output is delta 0 convolved with mu, which is mu. So mu is the response to the impulse input, and so it's called the impulse response. And in practice, these types of convolution systems arise in engineering from underdetermined differential equations of the type d by dt xt is equal to axt plus but, and yt is equal to cxt plus dut for t greater than or equal to 0, where the state xt at any time belongs to a known Hilbert space x. The input function u is scalar valued, and the output function y is also scalar valued. And the a, b, c, and d are known operators between appropriate spaces. So for example, a maps vectors in x to vectors in x, b goes from scalars to vectors, c takes vectors to scalars, and d takes scalars to scalars. And these, so if you look at the first of these equations, we notice it is an underdetermined differential equation, in the sense that the u, the input u, can be chosen arbitrarily on 0 to infinity. And once we make a choice for this u, then given the initial condition x at 0, it determines a unique x. And once the x is known, also the output y is determined by cx plus du. So it's something, this differential equation is something which maps inputs to corresponding outputs. And if the initial condition is 0, in fact the relation between the input and the output is given by convolution with a measure, which can be expressed in terms of the a, b, c, d operators like this. And another equivalent way of writing this convolution relation is by taking Laplace transforms, because then the convolution is converted into multiplication, and the Laplace transform of the output is related to the Laplace transform of the input by multiplication by Laplace transform of the impulse response, which is now called the transfer function. And this transfer function is a holomorphic function in some right half plane in the complex plane. So it's via taking Laplace transforms, basically, that holomorphic functions enter control theory. And these type of underdetermined systems themselves arise when you have a system of high order linear ordinary differential equations with constant coefficients, which can be written as a first order system, or even delay differential equations which are linear can be written as such a thing without a delay, or even some linear partial differential equations can be rewritten as such an ordinary differential equation with appropriate choice of the spaces and ABCD operators. So let me give you some quick instances of this just to show that these kind of things do arise in practice. So if you consider a simple electrical network like this, comprising a resistor, capacitor, and an inductor, and if you think of the voltage applied here as being the input, and the voltage measured across the capacitor as the output, then the relation between U and Y is described by a differential equation of the type I described before here. And if the initial conditions are zero, then the Laplace transform of the output Y is related to the Laplace transform of the input U by multiplication by this rational function in S, which is the transfer function. So S is the Laplace transform variable. And similarly, if you have a delay differential equation, there's a delay over here, then the corresponding transfer function is this non-rational transfer function. And if you have even a linear partial differential equation model like this diffusion heat equation with Neumann conditions, and at the other end you are supplying heat at a rate ut, and you are taking as output the temperature measured at psi zero, then again there is a transfer function relating the Laplace transform of the input and the output. So these kind of things do arise in practice. So for us, a linear control system is basically has its transfer function description. So we think of a control system in terms of its transfer function. And the Banach algebra A plus that we are going to consider, that serves as the set of transfer functions of stable control systems. And what's a stable control system? Well, it's one which always maps nice inputs U to corresponding nice outputs Y. So for example, square integrable inputs to square integrable outputs, or bounded inputs to bounded outputs, L infinity inputs to L infinity outputs, and so on. And for us, a stable control system will be one whose transfer function is in fact in this Banach algebra A plus that we are going to consider. So I'll soon give the definition, but right now let me mention that this serves as a set of transfer functions of stable systems, because whenever you feed in an LP input and the transfer function is in A plus, the corresponding output is also in LP. And in fact, we'll soon see what the norm is, but one even has such norm control that the LP norm of the output divided by the LP norm of the input is bounded above by the A plus norm of the transfer function. And in fact, if P is 1 or infinity, we even get equality there somehow, although I'm not saying what the norm is. So, okay, so what is this A plus? So A plus is the set of all Laplace transforms of impulse responses of certain stable control systems. So mu is a complex Borel measure on R. So when I say a complex Borel measure, I mean it's finite, and so it has total variation which is finite. Yeah? And its support is in the half line on 0 to infinity, and it does not have a singular non-atomic part. So since we have such a complex Borel measure, we do know that when you convolve with any LP function, the corresponding output will also be in LP. So this proposition makes sense. And why do we remove the singular non-atomic part? Because it's just messy, and these kind of things don't really arise in engineering practice. And also, when you don't have a singular non-atomic part, then any such impulse response, any mu, by Lebesgue decomposition, has a decomposition into an almost absolutely continuous part, okay, which is basically an L1 function, and then a weighted sum of Dirac measures. So the Laplace transforms of these objects, they are complex valued functions in the right half plane. So here C with the subscript greater than or equal to 0 means the set of all complex numbers with a non-negative real part. And because of this Lebesgue decomposition, you have that these are functions which have a decomposition into the Laplace transform of an L1 function. And then each of those Dirac measures gives rise to an exponential. So you get a weighted sum of exponentials. In other words, an almost periodic function. So this FA is an L1 function, and these FKs are complex numbers which are summable, and the TKs are non-negative numbers because the support is in the half line, and with the convention that T0 is 0 and the rest are positive. So equipped with pointwise operations, this becomes a complex algebra, and in fact it becomes a Banach algebra if we equip it with this norm. So the norm of any transfer function in A plus is taken as the total variation of the associated positive measure. And in terms of this decomposition, it is the L1 norm of FA plus the little L1 norm of this sequence of weights. And as I mentioned before, this is a useful algebra in control theory because it's the set of transfer functions of stable systems. So it's useful to keep such a picture in mind. The impulse responses of stable systems look like this. They have a decomposition into an L1 function and then a weighted sum of Dirac measures. And these TKs are not fixed, but they have to be non-negative. And then when you take Laplace transforms of these things, then you get elements of A plus. So these are bounded and holomorphic functions in the open right half plane. So every element over here is an element in the Hardy algebra of the open right half plane. So this, however, elements over here have a continuous extension to the imaginary axis. So it's smaller than H infinity of the right half plane. Okay. But they don't have a extension to the point at infinity because of the presence of these exponentials with positive TKs. So the elements in A plus look like this. They have a decomposition into the Laplace transform of an L1 function, and then the weighted sum of exponentials, which is an almost periodic function. So for us, a stable control system is one whose transfer function is in A plus, and then an unstable control system or a non-stable control system will be one whose transfer function is not necessarily in A plus, but mathematically we assume that it is in the bigger set, the field of fractions over A plus, which is roughly speaking the set of all n by d's, where n and d are in A plus and d is not equal to 0. So even if our transfer function is not in A plus, nevertheless we assume that it can be written as a ratio of two things in A plus. And it turns out that this way of thinking, of viewing an unstable control system transfer function as a ratio of two stable ones, is profitable in control theory. You can solve some control theoretic problems in this manner. So for example, if you look at the transfer function 1 by s minus 1, that's not in A plus because it has a pole at 1, whereas things in A plus were supposed to be holomorphic in the right half plane. But nevertheless, you write it as a ratio of two things like this, 1 by s plus 1, which is in A plus, divided by s minus 1 by s plus 1, which is also in A plus, so this is in the field of fractions. So this is what is done in order to solve some control theoretic problems. And one such problem is the stabilization problem. And it is in this problem that the Corona theorem for A plus plays a role. So I'll soon explain what the role is. But what's the stabilization problem? Roughly speaking, you have been given an unstable control system, and then you want to find another system such that if you interconnect these two, then it's stable. Okay? So more precisely, given a control system with a transfer function P in the field of fractions, so this is often referred to as the plant. Think of a chemical plant or something like that. So what we have in mind is a box which maps inputs to outputs, but it may not necessarily map nice inputs to nice outputs. So we want to change that. So we want to find a controller, which is another system with a transfer function C in the field of fractions. And what this controller is soon going to do is it's going to measure outputs of the plant and produce better inputs to the plant so that something nice happens, namely that the interconnection is stable. So the stabilization problem is, given a P, find a C such that each entry in this 2 by 2 matrix is in A plus. So where does this matrix come from? Well, the P and the C are connected like this, and you view these two as inputs and these two as outputs, and then there is a map which sends inputs to outputs, which can be expressed in terms of the P and C, and that's exactly that matrix. So when we demand that each entry of this matrix is in A plus, we are demanding that nice inputs over here are mapped to nice outputs over here. So even if the old plant was not stable, now by interconnecting this controller, the overall interconnection is stable. So that's the stabilization problem. And why look at this problem? Because it arises in control engineering, and engineers want to solve this. So of course, if I choose any C in the field of fractions, each of these entries is in the field of fractions. But we want something more to happen, namely that each of these entries is in the smaller set A plus. So it turns out that this stabilization problem can be solved completely if and only if P has a coprime factorization, by which we mean that the P can be written as n by d, where n and d are in A plus, and they are coprime in the sense that there exist x and y in A plus, such that nx plus dy is 1, so the Bézout equation is solved. So we already foresee that the Corona theorem is going to play a role, and I'll soon make precise what I mean by that. But let's at least see that if P has a coprime factorization, then P is stabilizable. Because we can write down a formula for the controller. If P has a coprime factorization, then you can solve this Bezier equation. And so you have the x and y at hand, and you can set C equal to minus x by y, and it can be seen that this stabilizes P. So to check that it stabilizes P, we would have to check that each of these entries is in A plus. So let's look at the 1-1 entry over here. That's P divided by 1 minus PC. But P is n by b, and c we are taking as minus x by y. So if we do the algebra and take dy on the top, what we are left is with is nx plus dy in the denominator. That's 1, the d cancels, and we are left with n times y. But n was in a plus, y was in a, is in a plus, so the product is in a plus. So at least the 1-1 entry is in a plus, similarly all the others are as well. So in light of this result, it makes sense to ask, if p is equal to n by d, then are there x and y such that this Bezier equation can be solved? And here is where the Corona theorem gives a test for us to do that. So here is the Corona theorem for A plus, and to the best of my knowledge, I found this statement only in this paper. So what happened? Right. I think the computer died. Yeah. Oh, is it the institute? Oh well. So here is the statement of the Corona theorem for A plus, proved by Callier and Lesueur in 1978, which says that if n and d are in A plus, then the following two statements are equivalent. The solvability of the Bezier equation in A plus is equivalent to the usual Corona condition, namely that the modulus of ns plus ds is bounded away from zero in the right half plane. So this is the same Corona condition as for the Hardy algebra of the right half plane, except that we are saying that if you start with data in A plus, then for solvability in the smaller algebra A plus, the same condition suffices. And the proof of this basically relies on the description of the maximal ideal space of A plus, which was known and given, for example, in the book by Hill and Phillips from 1957. So what I want to do is to first give a description of this maximal ideal space and then also outline the proof of the Corona theorem for A plus. So it turns out that the maximal ideal space of A plus has a description as opposed to the maximal ideal space of the Hardy algebra, and complex homomorphisms in this maximal ideal space are basically of three possible types. There are of course point evaluations in the right half plane, but also now on the imaginary axis, because things have a continuous extension to the imaginary axis. So if you have any S in the complex plane with a non-negative real part, then there's a corresponding complex homomorphism, which is simply evaluation at that point. So that's one type of complex homomorphisms. Then there's another complex homomorphism, which is evaluation at plus infinity. So you pass the limit as S tends to plus infinity, it turns out that that exists. And since it has another description, namely that mu hat has a decomposition into the Laplace transform of an L1 function and then an almost periodic part, but the first T0 was equal to 0. So that's the constant function 1, and the rest of them were positive. So when you pass the limit as t tends to infinity, this part goes to 0, this part goes to 0, and all that survives is F0. So another description of this second type of complex homomorphism is all the Laplace transform of L1 functions are sent to 0, and only the almost periodic part is used, and it's picking out the coefficient of the constant function 1. And then there's a third type of complex homomorphisms corresponding to a non-negative sigma and chi a character. So I'll soon explain what I mean by character. And this type of a complex homomorphism corresponding to such things shares a feature with this plus infinity, in that all the Laplace transform of L1 functions are sent to 0. So it also only uses the almost periodic part. And it is like point evaluation, although not quite. So if I were to evaluate this almost periodic part at the point sigma plus I omega in the right half plane, okay, then I would get fk e to the power minus sigma tk times e to the power minus I omega tk. But instead of that latter thing, you are replacing it more generally by the character evaluated at tk. So what's a character? Well, it's a function from 0 infinity to c, which pointwise has modulus 1, just like e to the power I omega t. And it has this semigroup homomorphism property, just like e to the power I omega t. But these characters can be weird. They can be non-measurable and so on. So they don't have to be exponentials. So pictorially, the maximal ideal space contains a copy of the right half plane, the point at infinity, and then there is something which only acts on the almost periodic part, where again you have a copy of the right half plane. But besides evaluation at sigma plus I omega, there are also these weird characters. So there's more stuff living above I omega, if you like. So we'll give an outline of the proof of this theorem, and we'll show this by starting with a homomorphism, which is not point evaluation or evaluation at plus infinity, and we'll show that it has to be of the third type. So we'll create a sigma non-negative and a character, and show that phi corresponding to sigma and chi is the phi that we have started with. So first of all, in order to do this, there are several steps, and we'll first show that if you have a homomorphism which is not point evaluation or evaluation at plus infinity, it has to send the Laplace transform of every L1 function to 0, and we'll proceed by contradiction. So we'll suppose that there is some bad FA star in L1 such that its Laplace transform is not being sent to 0, and then we'll show that this forces the phi to be point evaluation. But we are starting with something which is not point evaluation, so that will be the contradiction. And the way we'll show that it is point evaluation is by first showing its point evaluation on a smaller algebra. So instead of taking, we are just ignoring this positive exponential part, and then you have the smaller algebra, Laplace transform of L1 functions plus constants. But this is a well-known algebra. It has a maximal ideal space, which is the right half plane with the point at plus infinity. And this is simpler because it has limits at infinity. And for example, a one-page proof of this result is given in Rudin's real and complex analysis. So we'll accept that result, and we'll assume that there is a function which is whose Laplace transform is not being sent to 0. And that means that it's restricted to this smaller algebra. It's a complex homomorphism because it's non-trivial and multiplicative and all that. So it belongs to the maximal ideal space of the smaller algebra, but that's just the right half plane together with the point at infinity. It can't be the point at infinity because otherwise this would be 0. So it has to be point evaluation at some point. So at least on the smaller algebra, it's point evaluation. But now we can see that it's point evaluation in the bigger algebra as well, by noticing that, first of all, if you multiply the Laplace transform of mu, any mu in A plus with FA hat star, then that's something which is the Laplace transform of an L1 function. And this is simply because, remember that this was the set of transfer functions of stable systems. So if you think of this L1 input, then the output is also in L1. And then by using the homomorphism property, you know that phi of any mu hat in A plus can be expressed like this. But now since this is the Laplace transform of an L1 function, it's point evaluation. And then the common factor cancels, showing that it's point evaluation on the bigger algebra as well. But that's a contradiction because we had started with something which was not point evaluation, which means that this boxed statement is true. So if you have something which is not point evaluation or evaluation at infinity, it has to send all Laplace transform of L1 functions to zero. So such things are sent to zero. But what is its action on the other part? Well, we'll show that in fact each of these exponentials is sent to a non-zero number, and that will allow us to construct the sigma and the character. So again, we'll proceed by contradiction and assume that there is some exponential corresponding to a T star which is being sent to zero. Okay. And we'll show that this forces phi to be evaluation at plus infinity. But again, that was not allowed because we are starting with something which is not of that type. Now, if there is an exponential corresponding to T star which is sent to zero by phi, then also all future exponentials will be sent to zero. This is simply because of the homomorphism property, because any future exponential can be written as a product of the exponential at T star times an element in A plus. So whenever it's zero for T star, it's zero for all bigger T's as well. And again, by the homomorphism property, if it's zero for some T star, it's zero for T star by 2 as well, because of this relation. But then the moment it's zero for T star by 2, it's zero for all bigger T's. And we can keep repeating this procedure, and we'll get that all exponentials corresponding to positive t's will be sent to zero. So this is sent to zero, all this is sent to zero, and so it's just picking out f0, and so it is evaluation at plus infinity. But it wasn't that. And so this contradiction shows that each of these exponentials is sent to a non-zero thing. And this allows us to construct the sigma as follows. So we consider the function g of t defined by log of the modulus of this. So since this is non-zero, this is well defined. And using the homomorphism property of this phi, it can be seen that g is additive. So g of t1 plus t2 is equal to g of t1 plus g of t2 for non-negative t1, t2. But this doesn't imply really that g has to be linear, okay? Because thinking of R as a vector space over Q, you can, using Hamel basis, construct weird functions which are additive, but don't have to be linear. However, in our case, the phi is bounded above by 1, because of which the g is bounded, and together with additivity, this implies right continuity of g at all points. And the moment you have continuity, it prevents the additive function from being weird. And so it has to be linear. And so there is a non-negative sigma such that gt is minus sigma t, because g was bounded above by 0. And so gt is minus sigma t. So taking exponentials on both sides, we know something about the action of phi on exponentials. It has to be like this. So now we have created the sigma, and we still have to create the character. But now we simply define it to be this action of phi on the exponential divided by its modulus. Then pointwise its modulus is 1 clearly, and using the homomorphism property of phi, it also has the second property demanded of a character. And so this is all that remains to do is now to check that the action of phi corresponding to this constructed sigma and tau is coinciding with the action of the phi that we started with. Well, any mu hat has a decomposition into these three parts. The action on this first part is 0, and the action on the second part we write in this polar decomposition, and this is precisely the definition of our sigma, and this is precisely the definition of our character chi. So we see that it is of the third type. So what we have shown is that any complex homomorphism which is not of these two types necessarily has to be of the third type. And so we have characterized the maximal ideal space of this A plus. So using this description of the maximal ideal space, it is possible to give a proof of the corona theorem for A plus. So we assume that the corona condition holds and that the corona data satisfy this. There's a positive delta such that mod ns plus df is greater than or equal to delta in the right half plane. And let us suppose that the Bézout equation is not solvable, so there are no x and y in A plus such that nx plus dy is 1. So the ideal generated by n and d is a proper ideal, so it's contained in some maximal ideal, but maximal ideals are kernels of complex homomorphisms, And so there is in particular some complex homomorphism which kills N and D. But we know what complex homomorphisms are, so hopefully we can get a contradiction. Clearly, the complex homomorphism can't be point evaluation in the right half plane because we immediately get a contradiction to the corona condition. It can't be evaluation at plus infinity either, because if the limit as S tends to infinity of both N and D at S is 0, then we also get a contradiction by passing the limit as S tends to plus infinity here. So the only possible choice is that the complex homomorphism is of the third type. Namely, there's a non-negative sigma and a character chi such that phi n and phi d are 0. And hopefully we can get a contradiction here too. But it's going to be harder because these are not really evaluations, whereas the corona condition says something about evaluations. So, but nevertheless, we can do that. So let's see how to do that. So n and d have such decompositions. And of course, there is no reason why these tk's are the same. So I've denoted them by different symbols. And what we know is that nk, I mean, this sum is equal to 0 with these characters. Now, it would be great if I can replace this character by evaluation at, I mean, e to the power minus I omega star tk for some omega star, because then it would be at least evaluation of the almost periodic part at sigma plus I omega star, and there is some hope of getting a contradiction here. So what we are asking is that can I find the omega star in R such that I can make this replacement, and maybe the sum is not 0, but perhaps we can keep the size still very as small as we please. And indeed, this can be done, and this can be done using a result in Diophantine approximation in number theory, and it's the following classical result, Kronecker's approximation theorem, which says the following. That if you have n real numbers which have which are rationally independent, so you are looking at R as a vector space over Q, and then these n numbers are linearly independent as vectors, then you can stack these numbers in a column vector in Rn, which has independent, rationally independent components. And then Kronecker's approximation theorem says that if you look at the set Rv plus Zn, so you are scaling your vector and translating by all possible integral lattice points, then the set you get is dense in Rn. And using this, somehow one can make this replacement in the following way. You first truncate this and remove the tail, and then you find a set of n numbers such that the span of those n numbers contain these tk's, and then a short argument can be given which allows you to make this replacement using this Kronecker theorem. So I won't outline that argument. But this Kronecker's approximation theorem itself, several proofs of this are known, which can be found, for example, in this nice book by Hardy and Wright, Theory of Numbers, in which the whole of chapter 23 is devoted just to this Kronecker's theorem. And in particular, there's a sort of one-page proof, which is particularly nice. It is it uses just elementary calculus given by Harald Bohr, the brother of the physicist Niels Bohr. They introduce this Kronecker's theorem by saying that it is one of those results in mathematics which say that if something is not impossible, it will happen sometimes, however improbable it may be. And they give the following astronomical illustration. So imagine that you have planets moving in concentric circles around about the center where there is an observer. And they are moving in a plane. And imagine that the innermost planet has the biggest radius. So then there is a possibility that this innermost planet can eclipse all the other planets. And of course, if there are just two planets and they are diametrically opposite to begin with, and they have equal angular speeds, then there is never going to be an eclipse. But Kronecker's theorem says that if the angular velocities are rationally independent, then occultations recur continually, whatever the initial positions. Anyway, so the upshot of it all is that using this Kronecker's approximation theorem, one can make that replacement of the characters by such exponentials. So there is an omega in R, basically, such that when you evaluate the almost periodic parts at sigma plus I omega star, the size is not too big. So earlier with the characters it was 0, But now when you make the replacement with omega star, you can still have control over the size. Now, the corona condition of course says something not just about the almost periodic part, but there is also the Laplace transform of the L1 part. It's not just this, but also this. However, this part is harmless because if you fix an omega, so if you are looking in the right half plane, and you fix an omega and you think of the, you fix a sigma and you think of the omega as variable, then this part, as the omega goes to plus infinity, goes to zero. So anyway, that part can be made as small as we please, provided we can choose this omega star very large, because then that part is small anyway, and the almost periodic part is less than delta by 4, and so we'll arrive at a contradiction. So the question is, can we choose this omega star as large as we please? And the answer is yes, because these are almost periodic functions in omega with a fixed sigma. So if something is happening for some omega star, say being almost periodic, it will keep happening for bigger and bigger omega star. Almost periodic functions have this property that epsilon translation numbers are relatively dense. So I won't go into what this technical jargon means. But basically it says that if you have a positive epsilon, then there's something which acts as a period length, so that whenever you take any interval of that length, there's a lambda such that if you compare the value of f at omega versus the value at the shifted version of the function, the error is smaller than epsilon that you began with. And a proof of this can again be given using a number theoretic result, similar to Kronecker's theorem. So it's not deep. So the upshot of it all is that we can select a sequence of points now, such that instead of evaluating the almost periodic part at omega star, if you replace it by evaluation at omega n, we don't incur too much error. And so the proof of the corona condition can be finished like this. We simply take s equal to sigma plus I omega n. The L1 part is harmless because of the Riemann-Lebesgue theorem. That part goes to zero anyway. So by taking a large omega, large n, we can make this as small as we please. And the almost periodic part size can be kept small. And there are two steps here. First, replacing the character by evaluation at I omega star, and then replacing the I omega star by I omega n, again without incurring too much error. So even the third type of homomorphism is not possible, and so our original assumption that this was a proper ideal was false. In other words, there are x and y in a plus z, nx plus dy is 1. And so the Bezier equation can be solved. So we remark that the proof is highly non-constructive. So it would be good to have a constructive proof of this, but a more down-to-earth problem is the following sort of engineering-motivated problem. Namely that if you have corona data of this type, where you have a polynomial in 1 by s plus 1, plus a polynomial in e to the power minus st. So this is a simplification because this part basically takes care of the L1 part. And as opposed to having general tks, it makes sense to have these tks being multiple of a fixed period, because in systems, typically there is a delay in one component, and that's producing all these delays. So for such corona data, which is simpler than our A plus, is there a constructive method for finding x and y in A pluses that the Bezier equation can solve? So engineers are interested in solving this type of a problem. And finally, I'll also say something about the completion problem for A plus, because that also plays a role in the stabilization problem. So far we have been looking at control systems where the input and the output were scalar valued. But instead of that, you can look at vector valued inputs and outputs. So the only difference is that the transfer function, as opposed to being scalar valued, is now a matrix of size p by m with entries in this field of fractions in A plus. And one can still talk about the stabilization problem. And that stabilization problem can be solved if the transfer function has both a right as well as a left co-prime factorization. So earlier we had the notion of the co-prime factorization in the scalar case, but now in this matricial case, that splits into two notions, a right coprime factorization and a left coprime one, depending on whether you have mu hat can be written as n times d inverse with nx plus dy equal to identity. So here x and y are matrices with entries from A plus, or the other way around. So d inverse times n with xn plus yd is identity. So it turns out that if you have both a right as well as a left coprime factorization, then you can solve the stabilization problem. But for general rings, it turns out that these two notions are not equivalent. So existence of a right coprime factorization doesn't always imply the existence of a left coprime factorization. So instead of this A plus, if for example we consider this ring, the set of all real valued continuous functions on the unit sphere in R3, then with pointwise operations this is a ring, and it turns out that here you can give an example where it has a right coprime factorization but no left coprime factorization, and this is a consequence of the hairy ball theorem, which says that you can't comb the hair on a hairy ball. So it makes sense to ask the question as to what happens if the ring is A plus, then is the existence of a right coprime factorization equivalent to a left coprime one? And there's a general algebraic result which says that these two notions are equivalent if the ring has a certain property, and such rings are called Hermite rings. And what's this special property? Well, it's exactly the property that the completion problem can always be solved. So let me remind you what the completion problem was. It says that whenever you have a tall left invertible matrix, then you can complete it to a square matrix which is invertible in this matricial ring. So if that is always possible to do, then that ring is called a Hermite ring. And for Hermite rings, these two are notions are equivalent. The existence of one implies the existence of the other. And so it makes sense to ask, well, is A plus Hermite? And the answer is yes, and we'll prove this by using a result due to Lin from 1973, which gives a sufficient condition for the Hermiteness of a Banach algebra. And his result says that if the maximal ideal space of the Banach algebra, which is a topological space when you equip it with the Gelfand topology, the Wigstra topology, if that topological space is contractible as a topological space, then the Banach algebra is automatically Hermite. And this sort of a theorem makes sense because when you have a Banach algebra, then every element of that is really a continuous function on the maximal ideal space. So we can ask, well, these continuous functions, do they have a certain algebraic property? And it makes sense that it is perhaps related to some topological property of the maximal ideal space. And it turns out that in the context of this algebraic property, this contractibility suffices. So here contractibility means that the identity map on the maximal ideal space is null homotopic, so it is homotopic to a constant map. So there is some point in the maximal ideal space and a continuous function from the maximal ideal space times the interval 0, 1 to the maximal ideal space, such that the following happens. So we can think of this H as a family of maps from the maximal ideal space to itself, parameterized by time belonging to this interval 0 to 1. And when time is equal to 0, initially you have that this H is the constant map, the identity map, sending everything to itself. But when the time increases from 0 to 1, this map deforms, and the final picture you get at time t1 is that you have the constant map, sending everything to this complex homomorphism phi star. So that's what we mean by contractibility. And we can show that the maximal ideal space of A plus is contractible, and by Lin's result then it follows that A plus is a Hermite ring. So the way we do this is, well, we know what the maximal ideal space is, and so we simply write down an explicit homotopy like this. We just describe its action on each of these three parts. So point evaluations at S, T are sent to, again, point evaluations, but at a shifted point. So you translate this along the real axis. So when t is equal to 0, we have just log 1 over here, which is 0, so the point is not moving at all. And that makes sense because initially the H was supposed to be the identity map, sending S to itself in particular. But as the T increases from 0 to 1, this goes off to plus infinity. So this point is translating to plus infinity. And so all the complex homomorphisms start looking more and more like the complex homomorphism plus infinity. So what we actually show is that the identity map is null homotopic to the constant map, which sends everything to evaluation at plus infinity. So in particular, infinity is sent to infinity, and the third type of complex homomorphisms corresponding to a sigma and a chi, you don't touch the chi, but the sigma you translate. So this whole part is moved over here, and then it can be checked that H has all the required continuity properties and so on, which is technical, and so it can be shown that this maximal ideal space is contractible. As a consequence, we get A plus is a Hermite ring, and control theoretically in the stabilization problem, this means that whenever you have a right coprime factorization or A plus, you are guaranteed to have a left coprime factorization as well. Okay, so that's all I have to say. Thanks. No. I know that Jonathan Partington has some more special version of this one, but I cannot recall immediately what his class is. No. Yeah, it would be interesting to find out if delta 1 of this A plus is also half. Because for L1 Z plus, it is half. And for R plus also, it's half. Yeah. Oh, it's half for this one without the singular non-atomic part. It's similar proof, perhaps. Because you are removing something from all the measures. It doesn't depend on. Okay.
That point that singular part is removed for a reason, singular continuous part is removed for a reason, because it's in a big phenomenon.
Yes, the coronal theorem also doesn't hold. Yes.
But
yeah.
Thank you.